That's the J.J. Johnson Quintet performing Bag's Groove. It was recorded on August 29, 1958. Johnson, of course, is on trombone, Nat Adderley on cornet, Tommy Flanagan on piano, Wilbur Little on bass, and Albert Heath on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. With 2/3 of about 40,000 workers at Fiat Chrysler Automobiles rejecting a tentative contract last week, both the automaker and the United Auto Workers leadership are reeling from the stunning defeat, a harbinger, they fear, of what might happen with contract negotiations at General Motors and Ford Motor Company. The big three, you see, employ 141,000 workers. Alex Wassell, who was with us about 2 weeks ago, a veteran auto worker and member of Local 869, joins us now, and he'll be explaining why the rank and file voted against the new contract. Thanks, Alex, for joining us once again.
Well, thank you.
Well, you were skittish when we talked that the contract, in fact, would be ratified. You said there's a strong feeling among the rank and file about this contract. And indeed, it turned out that 2/3, 65%, said we don't want it. To what do you attribute this stunning, resounding rejection of the contract?
Well, I could reiterate some of the things that were published in yesterday's Detroit Free Press, stumbling block. Obviously, the language on a 25% cap on the number of lower-paid entry-level workers, that language was never enforced in the new contract. So roughly 20% of the workforce did not get an immediate raise to first-tier wages. So that's a big stumbling block. Also, the vague language on the creation of a healthcare co-op was a problem. Members are uncertain that you'd have to take on faith that the International Union and the other two auto companies would develop a healthcare co-op that maintained the level of benefits to the members and not increase costs to the rank-and-file UAW members. The attendance policy is still disliked and deemed very draconian and unfamily-friendly.
What's the attendance policy?
Well, basically, it's a your fault attendance policy. So let's say if you're sick, your child, your aging parent's sick, unless they go into a emergency room or a similar healthcare facility and admitted, you basically get an occurrence, six occurrences. And you're discharged roughly. Also, if you're tardy, let's say a half hour every other month, and you get six tardies, you're on the road to discharge. I mean, other workplaces, if you're only late a half hour every 2 months, you know, you're considered employee of the year status, But at Chrysler and the Big Three, you're considered retrobates and due for discharge. Let's see. Also, that there is no in this new tentative agreement, there was no grow-in wage progression for lower tier workers to ultimately reach top tier pay. And so that basically continues the two-tier system, which is much hated in the Big Three and at Chrysler FCA.
The two-tier system means that there are workers who were hired prior to 2008, and they are paid at a particular rate of pay, a much higher rate of pay. Those hired after 2008 are paid the lower wages, and this was a huge problem with the contract negotiations to begin with.
Yes, it is. It's a problem for economics for the lower paid workers that could barely get by and or buy the products they make, and it's a problem for all the UAW members who believe in the union principle of equal pay for equal work. It's something we hold dear, and it's something that must be fought for in this contract and future contracts.
What other items proved to be sticking points based on the way the workers voted?
Well, I think we went over the big ones, but also there's a thing called the alternate work schedule where we pretty much abandoned the principle of the normal 8-hour day plus overtime pay in lieu of a schedule where, we'll say at my plant, there's three crews, not shifts. There are three crews, A, B, and C. A crew works Monday through Thursday, roughly 5:30 to 4. B crew works Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, roughly 4 p.m. to 2:30 in the morning. And C crew, which is the one I'm at, is a swing shift, where I work two afternoons, which is Monday and Tuesday, from 4:30 in the afternoon to 2:30 in the morning. And I also work Friday and Saturday from 5:30 in the morning to 4 in the afternoon. Scientifically, it's been proven that people with the working swing shifts or late afternoon shifts are prone to health problems, tiredness, and the general ability to function a normal life with your family.
Well, they also rejected the contract's provision for no cost of living allowance. You don't get that in the new contract. You don't get the little bit of grace that they would give you as an employee to get a little discount on buying a vehicle. They don't get that. And most importantly, it seems as if Fiat Chrysler had made good its pledge to shift, to take the car production out of Detroit, essentially, and to Mexico for the production of several vehicle lines. Did they ever specify what kinds of vehicles would be moving from Detroit to Mexico and what kinds would remain?
Well, there was speculation, but I don't think there was any real product announcements or commitments in this this current tentative agreement that was voted down. But the speculation is that small car production would and midsize would go to Mexico, and what would remain would be trucks, SUVs, and minivans in the U.S. and Canada. Again, those are high-profit vehicles, but they're also very sensitive to gas prices. And so let's say if there was another huge spike in the oil prices, then demand for those vehicles would fall rapidly, and there would be subsequent layoffs and unemployment in the U.S. plants.
And all of this is, of course, against the backdrop of the signed or the soon-to-be-signed Trans-Pacific Partnership, basically discussing global trade, and the automobile industry, I'm sure, would be a major, major aspect of that. So we'll get to that later. But this rejection of the contract raises a very interesting question, because let's say the two-tier system, the newer employees who would be paid a lower rate, stood to gain some ground financially from voting for the agreement, but they did not. What accounted for the fact that the new employees decided to go in solidarity with the older employees on this question?
Well, actually, I think a lot of the younger workers, the entry-level workers, were actually at the forefront of the fight because they felt that that a promise was broken to them that was in the highlights of the 2011 agreement, saying that there would be a cap on entry-level workers at that level. So anything above 25% would roll directly into top wages. So that's 20% of the workforce right now. Also, it's a matter of trust. Some of the wage progression, the workers that were just hired in will say yesterday, they wouldn't get up to top wages in this contract, and you'd have to trust again that that progression would continue in the next contract. And I'm saying top wages for second tier. Workers were distrustful. They felt lied to in the last contract, and they had no reason to vote for the new one, even though they did get some wage progression over time. It wasn't enough to overcome the fact that they felt that it was time for them to get full wages.
I saw that in an article I read that it would take roughly 7 years for a newer worker to get to the point of top pay. But by then, they would have attritioned out, but in one way or the other, for the most part, they probably would not make it to the seven-year timeline in order to cap out at the top pay.
A lot of lower-tier workers do not stay at the company because for the reason that the pay is not that good. And with the alternative work schedule and no cost of living and stuff like that, they feel that they could have a better lifestyle working outside of the auto industry, and that's their decision.
This issue of pay is so central, of course, to any labor negotiation, but historically, this industry has been a major influence in upward mobility of workers in Detroit and in their for their relatives elsewhere, because a lot of money earned by Detroit auto workers ended up in the South, ended up in the West, ended up in other places as they supported their families on what was then considered a fantastic job, a really good paying job, a steady job, a solid job. When did this solid job become less solid? What was the turning point, you think? You've been with the union now for almost 20 years. What could you say was the turning point at which things started to fall apart?
Well, actually, I've been with the union a little bit longer than that. I hired in at GM in 1972 for full-time, and then I, when my plant closed, I moved over to Chrysler as a skilled trades worker in 93. But going back in history, I would have to say the early 80s led the first concession contracts, and it's been going downhill ever since. But recently, I would have to say the 2007 agreement was another concession agreement by all the big three, especially Chrysler and GM. They were hit the hardest, and subsequently both went into bankruptcy. You're right. UAW auto workers used to be solid working middle class wages and benefits, and that carried throughout society. And as our wages and benefits have stagnated or declined, so has the rest of the U.S. economy. And I'm just reading in the Free Press, they said that the median household income of Americans in 2014 was 6.5% below the 2007 level. So it's a problem. We all know it. It's recognized, and I'm proud to say my UAW brothers and sisters at Chrysler are trying to fight to rectify it.
When you used the word concession in this last answer, you used the word concession twice. You referred to the contract in 1980 and the contract in 2007, both as the first two major concession contracts. When you use the word concession, it means that the leadership basically yielded to the demands of the company. Is that what you think of the current contract as well? The tentative one that was just voted down, was that considered a concession contract?
Most people that I talk to believe so. I believe so. Although there are some minor improvements, when you don't restore cost of living, that's continuing a concession is a concession. When you have alternate work schedules where you're working anything over 8 hours at straight time, although in this contract Saturday is paid would have been paid time and a quarter on an alternate work schedule, that's a concession to the past practice of time and a half for overtime in UAW contracts. The attendance policy is harsh and a concession. In previous contracts, there would be good record days where employees that obviously that came to work every day and did a good job, they would have one or two good record days to take care of sickness, family obligations, and it wouldn't count against them. So for many reasons, it's another concession agreement. Also, the retirees did not see an increase in their basic benefits in this contract or a tentative contract. So I can't, there's so many ways to say it's a continuation of the concession agreements. So that's the way I see it.
Well, one of the things that the workers did do was authorize a strike or give permission for the union to declare a strike if things didn't go the way they thought they ought to have gone. That has not been exercised. Is that expected to happen in the near future? Because the union must now go back to the table with the automobile manufacturer, Fiat Chrysler. And is there going to be, this is going to be even harder ball, or is it going to be greater concession?
Well, okay, the strike authorization votes are usually pro forma, so usually there's a large percentage that vote for strike authorization, knowing that the leadership needs that to hammer out good agreements. Yes, the International Union is expected to sit down with Chrysler FCA bargainers and try to hammer out another deal. If they simply just sort of re-slice the pie or just repackage this agreement and basically being the same amount of money and benefits to the workers, I think it'll be have a hard time passing. We do have the ability to strike over local issues at different facilities while national negotiations continue. Again, that'll be the call of the International Union. What the rank and file wants is a good contract, and we will support any effort by the International Union to win one.
From the point of view of the president, UAW President Dennis Williams, is this a case where he says, look, this is the best we can do, and I mean, short of a strike, this is the best that we could do? Or is this a sign, this tentative contract that was just voted down, a sign that the industry has the upper hand here with a number of tricks up its sleeve that are legitimate and legalized and everything. The Trans-Pacific Partnership was one. The administration bailing out the industry. It's got a number of things going for it. It's got a number of good friends in high places that would basically look the other way as the industry tightens its grip in order to make a ton of money, which it is making now. So do you read this latest development either as a weakness on the part of Dennis Williams, a misreading of the authority and power that the union actually has, or is this a matter that the union was outsmarted by the CEO of Fiat Chrysler?
I don't think it's a matter of weakness or misreading by the international union leadership. I think it's a matter of philosophy. I think for a long time the international union thought it best to try to work in partnership with the companies all the time we were giving concessions. I think that time is long since passed. I don't think the auto companies or multinationals in general have any stronger hand than they had years ago. But I do think that it's important for workers to make a stand. And also, we must remember that they would lose a lot of money, just all the big three, if there are strikes. The Ford truck plant in I think it was Missouri just reached a tentative agreement averting a strike, but that is a red hot seller for Ford Motor, and they make a ton of money on every vehicle. So it's still a matter of dollars and cents, and the cost of paying the workers a decent wage and benefit package is minimal to the cost of a vehicle, and so you have to balance how much you want to lose versus the small amount of money you'll be paying out to the workers to produce high profit vehicles. I guess that's something we'll have to find out about in the future.
What do you recall as a contract negotiation process that you consider to be very effective and successful, and that for everyone involved, and that did not cost the company anything in terms of loss of market share, but quite the opposite? Where would you cite the point in time at which a contract was worked out that was, you know, decent, and people were generally satisfied with it? And what aspects did that contract have that the current contract did not have?
Wow. Well, we'd have to go back quite a few years. But I think historically, since post World War II up to the 1980s, I think it was a time when both company and union benefited from the negotiations and packages that the UAW won for its members. What sort of happened was they had two oil shocks in between. You know, oil prices spiked, and you had the election of a president in 1980, Ronald Reagan, that was very hostile to organized labor. And from that point, I think you've seen the pendulum change in the other direction. Is that good for workers or good for America? I think not. I think American workers, whether you're unionized or not, need a livable wage so they could buy products and pay taxes to support schools, roads, hospitals, and the like. Hopefully we will start turning that around in this contract cycle.
Considering that this is an industry that employs 141,000 workers, were you Were you surprised that none of the presidential candidates really cited this as a major issue?
I'm not surprised. It seems that presidential candidates would rather touch on hot-button issues instead of the basic economic issues that Americans face day in and day out. So I'm not surprised.
What about the union world? Did this effort, and of course the two others to come, the two rounds with Ford and with GM, what kind of messages are you getting from other unions as UAW members?
Well, from my group of friends and GM and Ford Motor, I'm getting very positive feedback. They want us to win a good contract, so they'll be able, in turn, to win a good contract. They're applauding our effort. And just last night, a good friend of mine who is a past president of a UAW local said that Dennis Williams and the International Union has done what they haven't done in a long time, unite the rank and file in opposition to this contract. So so we have a energized rank and file now. I hope the International Union takes that energy and hammers out a fair agreement for Chrysler FCA workers and Ford and GM also.
You kind of anticipated my question with that answer. And so I'll ask, with this re-energizing of the rank and file, is that re-energizing also including a re-examination of the rank and file's relationship to the leadership?
Yeah, I think the genie's out of the bottle. I think we're UAW members are questioning the whole democratic structure and how decisions are made at the UAW. I know a lot of people would like to have, a lot of members would like to have the direct election of the international leadership by the rank and file, something other unions have, as a way of a check and balance and a wake-up call for the folks knowing that If they don't deliver, they have a chance of being voted out of office the next term.
So,
I think this is good.
As we wrap up, Alex, could you give us an idea of what the timeline looks now? The union has to go back to the table with Fiat Chrysler. Is there some kind of a timetable by which they expect a new round of negotiations to produce something?
And the answer I give you is I don't know. They could go back and try to reach another tentative agreement before moving on to Ford and GM. But if things don't look good, they could postpone our talks and go to the other two. Or they could call selective strikes or a company-wide strike. I'm not privy to that information. I would hope that they just return to the bargaining table, and if they can't settle at Chrysler, move on to the other two, and I think that would give us a stronger position when they did finally reach another tentative agreement.
Thank you so much for being with us today and sharing these incredible insights with this very important story, the development of labor negotiations within an industry that concerns 141,000 workers and, of course, by extension, the people connected to them. Thanks so much, Alex, for being with us today.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. We'll take this break and come back and talk about a brand new product at Whole Foods. It's Free Range Employees.
Hey,
You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead. Over the next 2 months, Whole Foods Market will cut 1,500 jobs, a move, it says, that is necessary in order to bring costs down for consumers and to fund an upgrade in the company's technology. Well, as you know, Whole Foods it dominates the market of sustainable foods and organic foods and has grown to more than 400 outlets across the country. This cut of 1,500 workers represents the largest cut of such a magnitude that Whole Foods has never done before. So this is a precedent-setting cut. But what is interesting about this is that Whole Foods is born out of this philosophy, at least its co-founder and CEO, co-CEO John Mackey, who has written this book about conscious capitalism, has always said that, you know, there is a place for capitalism and it can have a conscience. It can operate sustainably. But now we see that Whole Foods has free range employees. You know, it's not a laughing matter, but it is so ironic. Well, I thought one of the best things to do at this point, since the announcement, and we'll come back to it after we hear from Mackey himself. Mackey is a proponent of this concept called conscious capitalism. And here in this tape that I want to share with you, he outlines not only his personal philosophy, but the philosophy that undergirds the spirit with which Whole Foods does business. And you will hear a number of things in this interview that will strike you as very, very ironic when we come back to elucidate and opine after this clip is played. Here he is being interviewed by Nick Gillespie of Reason TV. And this was just earlier this summer at Freedom Fest. This is the annual convocation of libertarians. And here, after participating in events that deal with monopoly and competition in business and his own philosophy, where he expounded even more on this idea of conscious capitalism, we get a sense from what John Mackey is saying, that he really has a problem with the intellectual class and its resentment about capitalism. So here he is, and we'll come back right after we hear this clip.
Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie with Reason TV, and today we're talking with John Mackey. He's the co-founder of Whole Foods Market and the co-author of Conscious Capitalism. John, thanks for talking to us.
Glad to be here, Nick.
From reading your book and from talking with you, you believe that capitalism is the greatest wealth, not only the greatest wealth creator, but it helps poor people get rich. It helps everybody along the way. But you see it as constantly being misrepresented, even by its champions.
Right.
Why is capitalism under attack?
Intellectuals have always disdained commerce. That is something that tradesmen did. People that were, you know, lower class. And so you had minorities oftentimes did it, like you had the Jews in the West. And they were, when they became wealthy and successful and rose, then they were envied. And then they were persecuted and their wealth confiscated. And many times they just run out of country after country. Same thing happened to the Chinese in the East. They were great business people as well. So the intellectuals have always sided kind of with the aristocrats to maintain a society where the business people were kind of kept down. You might say that capitalism was the first time the business people kind of caught a break, because Adam Smith and the philosophy that came along with that and the Industrial Revolution began this huge upward surge of prosperity.
Is it a misunderstanding of what business does? Is it envy? Is it like a lack of capacity to understand that what entrepreneurs do or what innovators do is take a bunch of things that might not be worth much separately and then they transform it? What is the root of the antagonism towards commerce?
It's sort of where people stand in the social hierarchy. Mm-hmm. And if you live in a more business-oriented society like the United States has been, then you have these business people who they don't judge to be very intelligent or well-educated, having lots of money, and they begin to buy political power with it, and they rise in the social hierarchy, whereas the really intelligent people, the intellectuals, are less important. And I don't think they like that. And I think that's one of the main reasons why the intellectuals have usually disdained commerce. They haven't seen it, the dynamic creative force, because they measure themselves against these people, and they think they're superior, and yet in the social hierarchy they're not seen as more important. And I think that drives them crazy.
What happens to a business person? I mean, because a lot of the times, and you know, they are plucky upstarts, they're innovators, they're disruptive, and they're fighting against the power. And then what happens that once they get to a certain point of influence or power, then they start to try and rig the market or freeze the market in their favor?
I don't know if it's a psychological switch so much as that they weren't necessarily grounded in the philosophy of capitalism. They weren't necessarily advocates of the free market. They were just advocates of their own advancement, their own personal enrichment. And so I think oftentimes they don't make a distinction between when they're entrepreneurs on the way up versus when they've arrived and they're attempting to not fall, so they try to rig the game, and we have crony capitalism that way.
We live in an age now, and you've talked about this a lot, where there are just an unbelievable amount of kind of government mandates that restrict the ability of business owners and employees to really negotiate about stuff. There's things as obvious as the minimum wage, where it says, like, under no circumstances a business cannot offer somebody less than this amount. How do these affect your ability to run a business that is in an extremely competitive market?
The impetus behind so many of these type of regulations in the workplace is, in a sense, to shackle business again, to get it back under the control of the intellectuals. Just like commerce, if you study the history of business, you'll see that most of the time in our history, commerce was controlled by the aristocrats. They had, the merchants were kept under their thumb, and now they've escaped, and we had this free market ideology that said the market should be determine all these things, and now they're systematically undermining that marketplace to get business back, get the genie back in the bottle. Of course, that will stifle innovation, it'll stifle the dynamic nature, the dynamic creative destruction of capitalism, but I don't think they're thinking about it that way. They just see business as this, you know, selfish. They're very concerned about the motives of business, and they see it as this selfish, greedy, and exploitative thing. Business people can't be trusted. Markets aren't just. They're not fair. So we need to intervene. We need to control this situation. And they fear markets. They fear the dynamic nature of it, and they don't like business people, so they feel perfectly justified in setting up all these regulations that restrict the freedom of business. Let's take the minimum wage, for example. It's a great example because, I mean, if you think about it for a minute, let's say Tom wants to go work for Whole Foods Market, and Tom is willing to work for Whole Foods for, you know, $10 an hour. And we want to hire Tom, and we think Tom is worth about $10 an hour, so we come together, and Tom's winning. We're not forcing him to work there, and he's getting benefits, he's getting opportunities to advance, learn new skills, and make more money in the future. We're gaining from it because we think he's going to be a good employee, and we think $10 is a fair wage. However, the government may not let us do that. They may say, you can't pay Tom $10 an hour because we're going to set a minimum wage at $15 an hour. So the government's basically saying, we know better. We know better what's for Tom, and we know better what's for you, and we're not going to let you guys freely come together and do voluntary exchange.
Well, now the argument is that, especially in an era where there's high unemployment and low labor force participation, it's a buyer's market. You could probably get Tom. He might be willing. He wants to work for $10 an hour. You could probably get him for $5 or $6. So the argument is that somebody's got to look out for Tom.
Well, first of all, I think Tom can look out for himself, but B, that's basically a myth. I mean, wages in a marketplace are determined by productivity. And why should we pay Tom even $10 an hour if we can control the wages? Well, why don't we just pay him 10 cents an hour? I mean, why not? Because Tom could go get a job someplace else that would pay him better. I mean, wages are determined through competitive marketplace dynamics, and wages will settle at the marginal level of productivity, meaning we might like to pay Tom less, but Tom's not willing to work for less, and he can get a job down the street that pays him what he thinks he's worth. So the competition between employers sets wages. When the government sets it, it's inevitably going to screw it up. It's going to set them too high. And so a company like Whole Foods Market, if let's say they say the minimum wage is $15, but Tom's only worth $10 to us, well, what we'll do is we'll restructure our marketplace so that we'll provide less service. I mean, we're actually a very high service supermarket, but if they make service too expensive so our customers aren't willing to pay for it, then the rational, logical thing to do would be to cut back, do less service, do more self-service, make people queue up in lines longer so that we can keep our labor cost under control so we can be competitive in the marketplace.
What are some of the other kind of less obvious regulations that really hinder the ability of business and individuals to come together or to be flexible and innovative?
There's hundreds of them, and most of them, as you say, are hidden. One perhaps that's not so hidden is Obamacare. Mm-hmm. Again, it's determining, rather than letting the marketplace determine health care in a competitive format, they're basically saying you must cover this. Let's say that they mandate that you must cover in vitro fertilization, which as far as I know is not really an illness or a health condition, but some lobbyist somewhere can jam that through. When they jammed that through in Massachusetts and forced us to cover that, we were paying an extra $750 a person for health insurance. And there's no free lunch. So if we're paying an extra $750 to cover everybody in the workplace so they can get in vitro fertilization, so someone sometime can get it, well, the result is they're going to get $750 less in compensation. And I think this is what people don't understand. If you mandate certain benefits, then the cash compensation is going to be less. Oftentimes, you'll see studies that show that real wages are stuck. Well, but real wages and benefits aren't stuck, but you don't necessarily see that.
So, I mean, so it might be that the pay is stuck, but the overall compensation,
correct,
the fringe benefits,
exactly,
et cetera.
They're forcing us to cover more things. If you're, mm-hmm, if you're forced to give paid time off, if you're forced to give maternity leave, then, mm-hmm, you're forced to give paternity leave. You must give this many vacation days. Well, those are all costs to the business. They sound good, but there's no free lunch there.
Right.
So if they're raising our costs through benefits, then necessarily total cash compensation,
right,
must be reduced. Then they say, well, you're gonna have to pay this much in, mm-hmm, cash compensation. Again, there's no free lunch. So we'll either have to cut back in labor or we'll raise prices to our customers.
Mm-hmm.
And they think incorrectly that you can somehow or another take it out of profits. Mm-hmm. But the profit fund is too small. In a business like Whole Foods Market, we pay 7 to 8 times more in wages than we actually make in profits.
Some of the hardest people to convince of your vision of capitalism are libertarians or conservatives who believe, you know, what Milton Friedman, one of your intellectual heroes, used to talk about is that the only responsibility of a business to it is to increase its shareholder values. Talk a little bit about how, what kind of resistance you get from people who are rock-ribbed free marketeers who find your discussion of capitalism being more broadly inclusive of not just shareholders but also other types of stakeholders. What kind of resistance do you get there?
Well, I get quite a bit of resistance. And it's a shame, because if you think about what really empowers the left to put high living wage compensation, minimum wages, or mandates a bunch of benefits, or puts additional regulations on the business, it's because they don't think business is good. They think that business exists simply to maximize shareholder value and make profits. So if that's really the motivations for business, if it's not a more inclusive philosophy, then they feel quite justified in hamstringing business, because they're basically a bunch of psychopaths running around just, mm-hmm, trying to line their own pockets. We can't trust them to do the right thing, so we're going to have to do it for them. So in a more inclusive view that business has these responsibilities to all its stakeholders, its customers, employees, investors, suppliers, and the larger community, if business behaved like that, the impulse to regulate and control would be lessened.
You think we're shifting into a mode of capitalism where, you know, the idea of doing good by doing well is really starting to come into focus and will start energizing the way people think about business and for-profits and non-profits and kind of how the two may not be so diametrically opposed?
I really do. I mean, when you asked me the previous question about do I feel like resistance from traditional free marketeers and libertarians, yeah, old ones. Mm-hmm. And as I say, social progress is made one funeral at a time. Mm. But young people are eager for these ideas. When I've oftentimes gone to business schools and talk about this, and I see the professors with their arms crossed, you know, saying that's not, you know, business is about shareholder value. But the students, the MBA students, they're lapping it up mm-hmm. because this is exactly what they want to believe. Yes, I can get rich and I can do good. Mm-hmm. That seems like a win-win strategy to them and to me.
When are the 365 stores coming out, and can you talk about that a bit? Or is
I can talk a little bit about it, but I can't say anything more than what we've already revealed publicly.
Yeah, that's fine.
Regulations that happens to exist.
What's that?
If we disclose anything to anyone else, it would be considered to be insider information. We'd have to either immediately do an 8K press release.
Let's talk about that. What is the when are the 365 stores likely to roll out?
They will be coming out in 2016.
Okay. So let's talk about that, and then if you could talk about
it. Well, you're the press in a way, so yeah. I can tell you, but once I told, oh my God, I told Nick Gillespie and Reason about 365, and we hadn't told anybody this, then they would feel obligated to do some kind of press release, or the regulators would come breathing down our neck.
What's the next big launch that you're going to be doing?
Well, the thing we're all really excited about is we're going to be launching a new brand and a new format store, which is based on our 365 Everyday Value private label. And we're going to be naming a store's 365 a by Whole Foods Market. That will be the full name of the store. And these stores, first, they're going to have a curated product selection that'll only be lower price goods. So you can find lots of inexpensive wine there, but if you want to get a $500 bottle of Cabernet Sauvignon, you might go to Whole Foods because you're not going to get it at 365. And you're not going to find $40 Breeze there either. Mm-hmm. So Whole Foods has always prided itself on selling the very best, highest quality we can find. We're still going to have great quality at the 365, but we're going to curate it.
Do you, people talk about Whole Foods as Whole Paycheck, and I know that that there are various price points in the store, but does that get to you after a while that people think they're mischaracterizing the store?
First of all, it's a cliche now.
Yeah.
So people that kind of laugh and are smug about it, it's like, hello, people have been saying that. It's a completely old joke. So I barely can ever read an article about Whole Foods that doesn't say it. Mm. So, yeah, of course, I don't like it.
So when are the 365 stores rolling out?
That's John Mackey being interviewed by Reason's Nick Gillespie about Whole Foods. And it's great that Mackey insists, and as he explains amply, Whole Foods is operating on ethical standards, very high ethical standards. However, we do know that this past summer, in June, the New York City Department of Consumer Affairs found that Whole Foods had been mislabeling its products for 5 years, since 2010, costing consumers a ton of extra money that they should not have been spending. Whole Foods still has not explained how that happened, only that it issued an apology. And in the apology, Mackey says, if for any reason you find that you're paying more than you should have for a product that in any way was either mislabeled or misweighed, and it works against you, we will either refund it or you can get it free. In other words, you have to now, as a consumer at Whole Foods, you have to double and triple check to find out if you're going to win this little arbitrary lottery in terms of whether you're paying for what you're getting, whether the store is operating in a fair manner. And in fact, based on that, a consumer and an investor in Texas, I believe, has filed a lawsuit, a federal lawsuit. Whole Foods is defending itself against a lawsuit in which the allegation is made that Whole Foods has lied to its investors. And the defendant, I mean the plaintiff being one of them, saying that the because Whole Foods was supposedly committed, and I'm quoting to this, Whole Foods was supposed to be committed to providing transparent, accurate pricing for all of its customers. And because it did not do that, it also lied to its investors. And it's on that basis that a federal lawsuit has been filed against Whole Foods. It is contesting that, but it was filed in Austin. And the plaintiff, Yohanan Markman, says that he's hoping that his lawsuit will turn into a class action because he says investors in Whole Foods have been misguided and deliberately misled about the conduct of Whole Foods' business. And just this past weekend, we learned that Whole Foods, only because a group in Texas decided to stage a protest against Whole Foods, only because it came to light by that group, End Mass Incarceration Houston, Whole Foods has announced that it will no longer use prison labor to supply its more than 430 stores with fish products and milk products and cheese products. Because these products, some of these, most of these products, come from companies that were basically working alongside the Department of Corrections in Colorado. It's called specifically the Colorado Correctional Industries, a division of the state's Department of Corrections, to put prisoners to work. And Whole Foods had said, well, this is a great idea. You just heard John Mackey explain that the approach to this free market, the conscious capitalism, is that everybody can profit. But they did not make it known that the fish products and cheese and milk products, goat's milk, coming from these industries that are using prison labor. So it has, in fact, issued an apology and an explanation only upon the revelation of this group in Houston, Texas, and saying that we will no longer do that. We won't use prison labor anymore, but starting in April 2016. By then, as you heard in his explanation, the new stores, the ones that will be technologically connected, that is, you're going to have to order your food or you can by app or something, they're moving forward, as they say, in the industry. And so these are going to be lower priced products. Hello, did you read that? Lower priced products. But if you still want to buy a couple of bottles of $100 wine or something like that, you'll still be able to get that. But I'm pointing this out to say the absolute hypocrisy of an organization that says that it is committed to operating in a new and ethical way. This conscious capitalism that as of 8 weeks from now will be will have produced a new group, a new product called Free Range Employees, 1,500 to be cut, and you can be sure that more will come as they upgrade the technology. So keep your eyes on Whole Foods, and we certainly will be doing so here on Lead Stories. Thank you so much for joining me today. I hope you learned something from this program. You can drop me a note at leadstories@gmail.com, and you should stay tuned. Coming up next, the Global Research News Hour. We'll see each other tomorrow. A pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. Bye-bye.